Why are the bishops so tone deaf? Why did we see all kind, basically, as I think you said it, George, the Democratic Party at prayer, but not really praying? I'm here today with George Neumeyer. He's going to give us a full review of this week's USCCB meeting in Baltimore. And before we do that, we will begin in our prayers. We'll start off with the Our Father in Latin. Nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Pater noster, qui est in caeli, sanctificetur nomen tuum. Adveniat regnum tuum, fiat voluntas tua, sicut in cielo et in terra. Panem nostrum quotidianum da nobis hodie, et dimitte nobis debita nostra, sicut et nos dimittimus debitoribus nostris, ne nos inducas in tentationem, sed libera nos a malo. Amen. All sainted bishops, pray for us. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Well, I'm here with George Neumeyer. He was following all of this very closely. A lot of interesting stories that came out of it. Of course, some controversies. Before I hand the mic over to George, I just want to remind everybody to subscribe. Please like the video. And also, you may have noticed for the past several months, there's a second channel called Dr. Taylor Marshall Highlights. What we do every week is Daniel cuts these down to little like 3-minute, 4-minute, 5-minute highlights of all the best quotes. So I'd encourage you, while you're here on YouTube, go over and subscribe to Dr. Marshall Highlights, and you can get just the highlights of each show. A lot of people like it that way. Okay, George, are you still in Baltimore or are you home now?
I'm back in New York City.
Okay, great. So just give us your impression of what the whole thing was like, and then we'll go into the specifics.
Well, you know, as you were saying, it was like the DNC at prayer, but without the prayer. You know, it's that old saw is passé at this point, because there's not a whole lot of praying that happens at these meetings, which of course take place not at a monastery or a retreat center, but at the Inner Harbor Marriott, which costs about $300 a night, and I'm sure the whole operation has to cost some, you know, in the millions, because so many bishops come and so many of their entourages come. And the security situation at this year's event was very, very tight. So they clearly beefed up security from last year when they were embarrassed by so many people coming up to them and saying, why haven't you done anything about the McCarrick scandal? So it's funny how the post-Vatican II justification for having bishops conferences at hotels was that would make the bishops closer to the people and they would be behaving more like regular people. And yet at these events, they all cower behind security guards, and they don't want to have any, they're the shepherds hire cops to make sure that the flock doesn't get anywhere near them. So that was the first thing that jumped out at me, is that, you know, here you have the United States bishops spending millions of dollars on an event at a 4-star hotel where they're talking about pastoral accompaniment while hiding behind and talking about gun control while hiding behind cops with guns. And it just shows how out of touch and how insular and how cowardly these guys basically are. But the event itself was basically, you know, it was a left wing powwow. You know, it was a chance for the bishops to get together and talk about the failures of society rather than their own failures. You know, they'd rather talk about illegal immigration and gun control and racism and issues like that. They'd rather talk about that than talk about the collapse of faith and morals within their own church, and talk about the problem of gay predation, which remains a huge problem in the church. And, you know, many of McCarrick's enablers, starting with Donald Worrell, were front and center at this conference. Donald Worrell continues to cast his sinister shadow over these proceedings. In fact, one of Worrell's proteges, George Murray from Youngstown, Ohio, he became the chairman of the Religious Liberty Committee, which is a very important committee. And it's pretty clear he was put there to make sure that committee never talks about LGBT issues. Mm-hmm. It was just the meeting represented business as usual, and it represented and it just gave the left-wing bishops an opportunity to renew their calls for amnesty, gun control. In fact, one of the bishops said that the American people should have virtually zero access to guns. That was a statement that came out of the event. There was a lot of talk.
Come and take them.
Yeah. And there was a talk about how, you know, we need to hear more homilies on racism, as if that's an ongoing temptation, daily temptation for most Catholics. I mean, it's ridiculous. They never talk about the sins that people could actually commit. They only talk about things that beyond the reach of most Catholics. I mean, is anybody tempted to start a nuclear war? Is anybody tempted to, you know, commit acts of racism at this point?
I don't know, George. I've been tempted lately to just go to Walmart and buy like 5,000 plastic straws and just throw them in my neighbor's lake.
Yeah,
I've been fighting that back, man.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing they were. That's the kind of thing they were focusing on, was you know, the temptations beyond the reach of most ordinary Catholics, and then but yeah, it ended up being you know, as one observer put it to me, it was just a complete mess, and most of what was said was beside the point.
Yep. Now, last year, if I remember correctly, there was a lot more demonstration, and I don't think they had their security quite buttoned down. So tell us how it looked different from last year to this year, both from the opposition side and then just when you said they're hiding behind armed guards or police officers or whatever. I mean, what does that look like? I mean, can anyone actually go into these events, or are they completely walled off to the public?
Well, they had security guards and cops, both plain clothes cops and I think, you know, attired cops roaming around the bottom floor of the Marriott. The public can go into the lobby and into the cafe, but I think the bishops this year were alerted to, we're basically told to avoid the lobby and avoid as much as possible the cafe. So the public parts, you know, the public parts of the Marriott were swarmed with security people, and the bishops, I think, were much more wary about appearing in any of the public sections of the Marriott. So they just basically stayed in the private parts of the Marriott. Although I did, it's funny, I saw one day, I was standing out in front of, or I was in the lobby, and it was lunchtime, and the bishops had broken for lunch, and who should I see walking together but Blaise Supich, Donald Worrell, and Michael Sean Winters of the National Catholic Reporter, which, you know, is, of course, the most heretical newspaper in the country. And
the
so here are two of the most important cardinals in the church hanging out with a heretic from the heretical National Catholic Reporter. And they were off, and they were going off to lunch at Fleming's Steakhouse, where, as one of my friends put it, they weren't going to be smelling the sheep. They were going to be smelling the lamb chop, the $40 lamb chops on the menu.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Now there was a few interesting stories. I followed it, but not as closely as you. We've got the preeminent debate on abortion, CNA, Catholic News Agency. I'm going to call them Catholic News Agitation. They wrote a hit piece on Strickland. They mentioned me on that. It was all just sort of slicing and dicing, but they really missed the point of what McElroy was trying to, and Supich and others were trying to push through there. Maybe speak on that.
Yeah, it was a kind of a quibble over whether to include a longer paragraph from Pope Francis in this document on forming consciences. And the Supich-McElroy side wanted more of the Pope quoted in that document, and then the majority side, or the side that ended up prevailing, the Chaput side, they didn't want the entire paragraph, I guess, from the Pope included in the document. So that was really the debate. But because McElroy stood up and he said it's not Catholic teaching, it's not Catholic social justice teaching to say that abortion is the most preeminent issue facing the world, He, by putting that cast on the debate, he in effect turned the Chaput side into the seamless garment. You know, it was the side representing the view that abortion is just one of many issues that the church should discuss. And so then Shapu and Strickland got up and they said, no, we need to continue to emphasize that abortion is the preeminent issue facing the church and the world. And so it was really McElroy who defined that debate in the way that led people to correctly interpret the vote, as I think you did, as a loss for the Supich McElroy side. And so really it was how it all came down is open to interpretation, but I don't think it's incorrect for Strickland to say that the defeat of Shapu and McElroy was a slightly positive development, and showed that at least some of the bishops, a certain percentage of the bishops do not want abortion to be simply subsumed into a larger body of issues and thereby trivialized.
Now, Bishop Strickland tweeted out, this was controversial, he tweeted out 69 bishops voted against the preeminent clause. Is it 60? Yeah, 69. I retweeted and I said 69 of these bishops aren't really Catholic. I caught some flack for that. You think that's accurate? Or was I too low on that number?
I think, yeah, if anything, that's an underestimate. Yeah. I think, I'm sure that the number is much, much higher. And the point I would make, I guess, about that debate is that nobody stood up and questioned the seamless garment emphasis of Pope Francis.
Right.
And nobody noted that larger quote or even the smaller quote from Pope Francis, in which he said there are other issues equally sacred to abortion. Nobody pointed out that line of thinking is problematic. You know, what are those issues that are equally sacred to abortion? According to the Pope, those issues would include immigration and the environment and racism. But in reality, those issues are not equally important to abortion. You know, there are millions and millions of dead unborn babies every year. How does that possibly compare to, the problem of racism or too much food waste or whatever the issue is that the Pope is discussing?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the moral issues that are being proclaimed by the USCCB machine are the same moral issues being proclaimed by the Democratic Party, the UN, the EU. It's all about immigration, racism, globalism, and environmental protection. No more plastic straws. It's a carbon copy of what we hear from the Pelosis every single day. It's like Bishop Greta and gang.
It is, yeah. Yeah, you could at this USCCB meeting, if you just took what they said and you put it into the mouth of Nancy Pelosi, nobody would be able to tell the difference.
No.
There was like zero Catholic content to most of the speeches that I heard at the USCCB, especially the ones on gun control, amnesty, the environment, and in general, the bishops want bigger and bigger government. You know, they want less freedom and more government. That's, that's their universal call, it seems. And as you point out, a lot of this is driven by self-interest. They're upset that the Trump administration is spending less money on the resettlement of immigrants, and which is the business that they're largely in. Their budgets for that work have been consistently declining over the last 3 years, and so there's a very there's an anti-Trump strain to a lot of their whining about what's happening at the federal level of government.
Yeah, I saw the Vatican news release that when they elected Archbishop Gomez from L.A. as the new president, the German release said that this was a statement against Trump by the U.S. bishops. That's how it was interpreted in Rome. Did you see that?
Not see that, but yeah. I can understand that. I mean, Gomez, for Gomez, the burning issue is amnesty.
Oh yeah.
He's put so much focus on that 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 you know that lends it, that makes it very easy for people to interpret this as an anti-Trump that the USCCB is positioning itself to be a critic of the Trump administration.
Yeah. When I saw that they elected Gomez, Archbishop Gomez of LA, I said, at last, the man's going to get his red hat. Finally.
Right.
He's going to get his red hat. You know, he's not had his red hat for all this time because he was seen as Opus Dei and conservative. And we've watched year after year the Los Angeles Religious Ed Conference just be, it's a dumpster fire of liberalism, modernism, liturgical abuse. Every year, you got James Martin and that whole agenda going every year right under the nose and the planning of Gomez. And we all thought, oh, wow, LA is going to be taken back. We've all realized, whatever, it's not going to happen. Gomez is one of them. All he talks about is amnesty and immigration. And he's been strong-arming and pushing away the faithful as they try to reach out to him. It's a major disappointment. And now he's been elected as the president. I mean, my suspicion is you got guys like Supich and Tobin coming to him and be like, look, we'll get you elected. We need you to play ball with us. We need you to turn up the Latino, turn up the Hispanic, turn up the immigration. And within a year or two, we'll get you that red hat. Do you want to play ball with us? Yeah, I'll play ball. Okay, you'll be president and we'll get you the red hat. Mark my words, folks.
Yeah, that's the other person who may have earned a red hat at the conference was McElroy,
mm-hmm.
because McElroy is, you know, the irony of that spat he had with Chaput is that McElroy might end up succeeding Chaput in Philadelphia because he's on the short list for Philadelphia to replace Chaput. And if that happens, he'll certainly get the red hat that was denied to Chaput. But you're right about Gomez that, and you can see that the sycophancy of Gomez to Chaput to Supich and McElroy and Wuerl was, you could see that when he said after that controversial vote on the preeminence issue, he said that he agreed with Supich and McElroy that it would have been nice to include a bigger chunk of what that document from Francis, but that he just, you know, it was just an issue of space in the document, and that you know, they just didn't have enough space for that, for a larger quote from Pope Francis. So that's where Gomez ended up placing the emphasis. He wanted to let everybody know that there was no philosophical meaning to the vote at all.
Did you know, speaking of all this environmental stuff, did you see the release that Pope Francis said today that he's going to change the catechism again?
Oh, yeah. And
the sin against the environment is going to be added, allegedly, to the catechism.
Yeah, he's been threatening that for several years. In fact, 3-4 years ago, he suggested that he said that sins against the environment should be confessed. And so I guess, you know, if you come back from Whole Foods with a paper bag instead of a cloth bag and you don't buy the cloth bag, that I guess constitutes a venial sin that you should confess.
No, that's sheer evil right there, George. That's evil. You didn't buy the cloth bag for an extra $10. You got the paper bag.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's and then didn't he several years ago he suggested, I think, that environmentalism be added to the corporal works of mercy.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that he did that.
Now it's interesting to me that we've got these bishops so out of touch, so tone deaf. They're railing against gun rights. This is America, people. This is America. Try that in Texas. Ain't gonna work. They're going against gun rights. Immigration, amnesty, all these things. Was there any discussion about communion for the divorced and sexually active? Was there any discussion? Answer me this, George. Was there any discussion about idolatry in Rome, the Pacha idols?
I didn't hear a word about the Amazon Synod, at least not in public. It's possible they may have discussed it in their private sessions, but I didn't hear a single word in public about the Amazon Synod. I didn't hear a single word about Amoris Laetitia's problems, granting communion to the divorced and remarried. I didn't hear a single word about the issue of pro-abortion politicians like Joe Biden and communion. You'd think that here we are on the verge of an election year, and the bishops have absolutely nothing to say about whether communion should be distributed to politicians who vote for abortion. I mean, talk about being irrelevant. I mean, the one issue that would make them relevant is withholding communion from pro-abortion politicians, and they won't even discuss the issue anymore. They've basically adopted the Pope Francis's position, which is you give it to everybody, and including the Joe Bidens and the Nancy Pelosi's of the world. I didn't hear anybody even during the sessions when the bishops could propose new topics. I didn't hear a single bishop say that the issue of communion should be raised at the USCCB meeting. Strickland, to his credit, did say that he said something like, "Don't you guys think that we should discuss the issue of guarding the faith, at these meetings?" It's a pretty basic. You think that, the issue of whether or not the faith, the deposit of faith, is being protected, that would be foremost in their minds. But of course, it isn't. That's the last thing on their minds. They don't want to talk about spiritual issues. They want to talk about temporal issues, and that, which is why they hold these stupid things at the Inner Harbor Marriott. They're acting like they're just like CEOs in the world, meeting for the I can't even call it a shareholders meeting because they don't want to have anything to do with their shareholders. Supich made the comment that he stood up and he said the gun. We have to acknowledge that the gun manufacturers are motivated by profit. which is ludicrous on many levels. But the most obvious level it's ludicrous on is that who is more motivated by profit than by that's U.S. bishops.
Why are we not talking about immigration? Because that's how you get money.
Yeah, they're constantly whining about how they don't have enough money, how we need to give them more money. They spend all this time on capital campaigns, on annual appeals, they hold the hands of dying widows so they can shake them down for millions of dollars. Nobody is more motivated by money than a U.S. bishop, especially now when they're all dealing with the exorbitant costs of sex abuse cases. I would say that the USCCB is more obsessed with money than the gun lobby is.
Right. Yeah, I mean, what they really love is this immigration thing, and I'm going to explain it for people. You and I have talked about it, but maybe people didn't see our previous chat about that. What goes on is, under Obama, any agency that would resettle a refugee or an immigrant would receive a price per head of resettled persons. So what happened is Catholic Charities and diocesan structures sort of reprogrammed their agenda so that they would start getting these grants, getting paid per head of immigrants. And so they were able to grow their diocesan programs. They were getting a lot of money. And then when Trump came in, they knew this was going to happen. He shut down so much of this relocation that they were no longer, maybe if they were, I'm just making numbers up because I don't know the numbers, but if they're doing 5 people a month, well, maybe now they're doing 1 a month. So a lot of places had to cut and fire a lot of people. When Trump came in, this has hurt the bottom line for so many dioceses, especially places like Los Angeles, which is huge. That is a major money sinkhole. It is an enormous diocese. It's way too big. It needs to be chopped up. I did a video on that called Against Mega Dioceses. LA is the obvious example of that. So in order for them to get money, especially in a place like California where you have a ton of illegal immigration, they depend on not a drip, but a flow of money from the government to resettle immigrants. So bishops like Gomez are hurting big time. Same with San Diego, all those places, even all the border diocese down here in Texas. It's the same way. All these bishops are bellyaching about Trump because Trump has turned off the faucet of money. And you know why else? People aren't given money in the plate. People no longer are, when there's the diocesan appeal, the bishop appeal, the cardinal appeal, people are saying, No money for you. Nothing. Zero. I did a poll on Twitter the other day. It had over 6,000 people on it, and it was about 87% said, I'm giving $0 to my bishop, to my diocese. People are fed up. So these bishops are scrambling. How do we get money? Under Obama, they were getting it from the state, 40%. Isn't that right, George? About 40%? Or that was the USCCB budget, right?
A huge chunk of their money was coming from the federal government. At one point, it was $100 million, I believe, and now it's down to maybe, I don't even know how much it was last year. It was probably below $10 million. Mm-hmm. It was funny during that session when they talked about that issue. They adopted this woe is us kind of tone, and they said last year there were only 4,000 people resettled. You know, as if it's a horrible thing. Why is it a horrible thing that fewer people are being resettled? Isn't that a good thing? Doesn't that mean that more people are staying in their home countries, which means that they're not, you know, being persecuted, or they're not in a situation where they have to flee to the United States and be resettled? So, yeah, they talked about that issue just in terms of their own self-interest. And as you're saying, yeah, they would not press so hard on that issue if there wasn't tangible overhead and staff benefits to getting all that money from the federal government.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about resettling. It's not exclusively about resettling immigrants. It's about keeping your staffs big and getting money for overhead. And they wouldn't be doing it if they didn't receive any profit off that or excess money off resettling immigrants. You know, they wouldn't do it. There's got to be a money bottom line to that that explains the volume of whining you hear from them on that issue.
Yeah,
but I find it funny. One of the things I found interesting was that the Catholic Campaign for Human Development, which is still, you know, as left wing as ever, and they're still attached to Cardinal Bernardine, and they give out, I believe, the USCCB this year gave out an award called the Cardinal Bernardine Leadership Award. Never mind the fact that Cardinal Bernardine earlier this year was credibly accused of abusing James Grine, you know, who was the church's primary witness in the laicization trial of Theodore McCarrick.
Wait, repeat that again.
James Grine was the primary witness against Theodore McCarrick that the Vatican used to laicize McCarrick.
So yeah, the Vatican, were you saying Mahoney, or were you saying Bernardine?
Oh, Bernardine.
Oh, yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Sorry, yeah. I heard it wrong.
So I'm saying that if the Vatican considers Grine to be a credible witness, which they do, because they used him in that laicization trial, then why don't they take seriously what he said about Bernardine? Which, you know, he said that Bernardine and McCarrick simultaneously abused him at that lake house in Chicago.
Yes.
And yet nobody at the USCCB has taken Grine seriously on that, to the point where they still give out a leadership award in the name of Cardinal Bernardine.
Yep.
And that was another thing that struck me was in the course of the conference, it came out that Nicholas D'Amorzio, the Bishop of Brooklyn, has now, the guy that the Vatican sent to Buffalo to investigate Malone, it came out that D'Amorzio has been accused of abuse. And I was told by a source that news just shook the conference. It scared the hell out of the bishops at the conference. It was like an earthquake at the conference. But they didn't talk about it publicly. But it really shook up the people at the conference to hear that D'Amorzio has been accused of abuse. And the significance of D'Amorzio is that he's another one of Uncle Ted's nephews. He was an auxiliary bishop under Theodore McCarrick in Newark. He was co-consecrated Bishop of Brooklyn by McCarrick and by John Smith, who's the late Bishop of Trenton, who is also a McCarrick crony who's been accused of misbehavior and corruption. And so all of D'Amorzio's connections are many of his connections are very dubious and call into question, even apart from this accusation that's surfaced. They call into question why the Vatican would have sent him to Buffalo to investigate Malone. Why was one of Uncle Ted's nephews sent to Buffalo to investigate Malone if it wasn't, you know, just a whitewash. You know, it appears that that the Vatican was hoping to whitewash the situation in Buffalo.
Yeah. And, you know, you got who was the one who was saying that kids are afraid to go to school now because of guns? Who was that? Is that Supich?
Supich probably said that, but Supich was the one who said, you know, the gun lobby is all, you know, motivated by profit. Yeah. And but there was a bishop who said, we need to work towards the day when private citizens have virtually zero access to guns.
Yeah, I'm not going to be in favor of that.
Yeah.
You know, I got a question for him. How about parents being afraid to have their kids around priests because of all the mess they've made? How about that?
Right. When I saw, it was funny, you know, they had a big, somebody took a screenshot of the agenda items on gun control. And it was, you know, universal background checks and, you know, improved mental health and that kind of thing. There was nothing about arming adolescents against gay predator priests.
Yeah.
Or, if McCarrick's victims had been armed, you know, things may have turned out a little differently.
Yep. Yeah, there's so many problems in the American Catholic Church. There are the Vigano allegations. There is the lack of investigation for McCarrick. There's McCarrick living in mid-America near a school. No one wants to talk about that. There is this huge scandal of them receiving so much money for resettling immigrants. No one wants to talk about that. There's this enormous scandal in Rome with these Pachamama idols casting a horrible shadow over the entire Amazonian Synod project. No one wants to talk about that. They come together at these expensive rooms, this expensive hotel. They prance around and they talk about straw, plastic straws, environment, guns. It's ridiculous. It makes me sick.
Yeah. And there's no discussion of the fact that all of Uncle Ted's nephews, like Kevin Farrell, Cardinal Kevin Farrell, continue to exercise immense power in the church. You know, Kevin Farrell is going to be overseeing the next conclave. And Kevin Farrell, I've been told by multiple, well, I don't know if I should get into this, but I'll just say that Kevin Farrell is a highly compromised figure. And it's going to come out at some point how compromised he is. And but there's no discussion of that. And it's an absolute scandal. All the major cardinals, Tobin, Supich, Worrell, Farrell, they're all connected to McCarrick very tightly.
Yep.
They all played a role in enabling him and covering up for him. And yeah, as you point out, the church still hasn't done anything about the fact that he's being housed by Capuchins in Kansas. And he's still on the faithfuls. The faithful are still, or at least the people donating to the Capuchins are still paying for his room and board. And there's a big story there, too, because McCarrick has tons and tons of money. And it appears that the church is waiting for him to die so it can get his money. And the other motive is that they don't want him to spill the beans on all these people, on all the gay mafia guys.
Yeah. That's the thing is, McCarrick knows so many stories. He knows about skeletons in closets. And man, if they start trying to punish him or go against him, all he has to do is just call up anyone in the news and start telling stories about any of these guys, including lots of people with red hats, not only here in America but abroad. It would blow up.
Yeah. He could, Kevin Farrell lived with him for 5 to 7 years or something. Uh-oh. Like 5, 6, 7 years. He could drop a dime on Kevin Farrell in a second.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, Kevin Farrell is probably telling everybody at the Vatican, we need to make sure that the report on McCarrick is very carefully worded so as to, you know, what's going to happen probably with that report. And that came up actually at the conference. At least a couple of bishops said, hey, where's the report on McCarrick? You know, it's been a year now. And O'Malley stood up and he said, oh, well, it's being translated into Italian for the Pope. And the Pope hasn't seen it yet. But when the Pope has seen it, it'll be released, you know, either at the end of the year or early next year. And I was wondering,
right.
are they Are they also going to be translating it into Latin? I mean, this is ridiculous. But at any rate, I forgot my train of thought there. What was I saying?
You were talking about Cardinal Farrell.
Oh, Farrell. Yeah. So Farrell is playing a role in making sure that report doesn't indict the current leadership of the church, but rather indicts the JP2 and Benedict era. We're going to see a report that'll splash a lot of dirt on the people around JP2 and Benedict, and maybe those two popes themselves.
Yeah.
But it's going to be very light on the role that the world's played in covering up for McCarrick.
Yeah, let us explain how it's all going to go down ahead of time for people. Here's what's going to happen. If Francis continues to live for several more years, they will wait for Benedict XVI Ratzinger to die. When he dies, they will release a lot of investigative reporting, which will lay all the blame partially at JP2's feet, mostly at Benedict XVI's feet, and they will scapegoat him. But they're waiting for him to die. That's what's going to happen. Do you agree, George?
Yeah, I think they're going to, they're going to pin the rise of McCarrick on JP2 and Benedict.
Yeah. Yep. And they're going to show that Benedict didn't do his job, and he was compromised, and that's why he had to resign. And Francis was the one who ultimately fixed it. That's the narrative. If Francis lives several more years, that will be the way that they run with it, and Francis will be the great reformer.
This is such an immensely perplexing time to be a Catholic, because you know everywhere you look in the church right now, there's pretty much nobody to trust. And that starts at the very top. And that one of the reasons why the USCCB appears so out of touch is that there's not a single mention at the meeting of the concerns of the faithful about the direction of the church under Pope Francis.
Yeah.
There's no discussion of that at all. You know, and so how could these guys possibly be representative of their flocks when they can't even acknowledge that the last 6 years have been at the very least just baffling, but at the worst just immensely scandalous.
Yep. Let's talk about some of the bishops there, because ever since the McCarrick thing's gone down, people are trying to figure out who are the good bishops, who are the good guys. We want to rally. We know, you know, we like Cardinal Burke, we like Bishop Schneider. Who are the guys in America that we can rally to? Now, I saw Bishop Strickland stick his neck out, and people are really happy. And he's been getting attacked all this week. Especially, I noticed today there's all sorts of buzz on Twitter and social media against Strickland, mainly coming out of the EWTN affiliate. What's it called? Catholic News Agency.
They're trying to pit Strickland against the Chaput's, you know, and say that Strickland's an extremist, which is ridiculous. You know, if anything, Strickland is too cautious. But I give Strickland credit though, because I saw him at the pro-life rosary outside of the Marriott. You know, some pro-lifers gathered outside of the Marriott, and Strickland went over there and he led the rosary. And he did it almost alone. There was actually one other bishop, and I was very interested to find out who this other bishop was. And it turned out to be a man named Bishop Joseph Coffey of the Archdiocese of Military Services. So he was there praying too, and so I was kind of impressed that Strickland, you know, was willing to just go out there with the so-called Catholic deplorables and pray the rosary. And so, you know, he is emerging, I think, as a good lead, you know, as a leader, and should be encouraged. But it's ridiculous for the CNA to suggest that he's somehow extreme in his Catholicism. He, as he himself put it, he's just an ordinary Catholic, and at this point, ordinary Catholicism is cast as extremist.
Right.
You know, anybody who's just simply adhering to traditional doctrine is marginalized as an extremist. But he's, you know, 50 years ago, 60, 70 years ago, they were all strict. You know, all the bishops would have been like Strickland. You know, now somebody stands up and says, you know, hey, let's not downplay abortion, and suddenly they're portrayed as, you know, being Randall Terry or something. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
So did I hear you correctly that it was the only two bishops that joined the Rosary were Strickland and it's Coffey, is his name?
And yeah, Joseph Coffey. Although the day before, Bishop Brennan, Mark Brennan from Wheeling, Charleston, he was just sort of kind of walking around outside, and he saw the pro-lifers praying, and he went over there and he prayed with them. So he, you know, I have to give him credit for that. He's not my, I don't have a whole lot of confidence in Brennan, because Brennan is, he's a former auxiliary bishop from Baltimore, and he was 40 years in Washington, D.C. And it's pretty clear that he was sent into Wheeling to do mop up after the Bransfield scandal, but to do it in a way that wouldn't implicate Wuerl and the other members of the gay mafia. So he comes off in person as very unassuming and innocent, but he also seemed a little not exactly up to speed on things, because I asked him about the Monsignor Walter Rossi investigation.
Mm.
Which is now in its third month. It's been going on for 3 months, and I said, what do you think of this investigation, and when is this investigation going to end? And his exact reply to me was, I'm not aware of this investigation. So that didn't speak well of his knowledge level of the problems in the church.
Now, I watched a really good clip. I wish I had it queued up so people could watch it. It's so powerful, but there was a vote to raise the tax on bishops' dioceses that they have to pay to the USCCB. They were voting to raise it, I think it was 3 percentage points. And Archbishop Chaput got up and he said, look, I'm already paying $500,000 a year.
Right.
Half a million. I almost fell out of my chair when I heard Chaput say that. He says, I can't afford to continue to give money to the USCCB, this seven-headed right. dragon. He didn't say that part. I added that. I can't continue to give money. I have to be accountable to the people back home who are giving me money. So everybody, just take a moment and think about this. Your diocese, wherever you live in the United States, is paying a tax to the USCCB.
That's right.
If you put a dollar in the plate, part of that money is going to funnel its way to the USCCB and pay for their 4-star Marriott hotel party. And that was $500,000 for one diocese.
Right.
That's Chaput.
Right.
That's Philly.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's ridiculous. It's
yeah,
just a waste of money.
I asked somebody how much the whole like proceedings, the USCCB proceedings in Baltimore would cost, you know, like how much for that 4 days, you know,
right.
total, like for all the, to, you know, fly in all the bishops with all their entourages, all their staffers. You see all these six figure, you know, lay staffers walking around very self-importantly.
Yeah.
And who's paying for that? We're paying for that. And this guy said, I said, how much do you think this costs to put this whole thing on? And he said, probably $5 million, something like that. I don't know if that's too high a figure, but basically, what Chaput was saying is absolutely correct. The USCCB does not deserve another dime. And I would actually argue that its budget should be drastically cut, and these meetings should be, disbanded and discontinued. And I think they could probably do their business in a much more minimalist sort of way. You know, they could meet at one of their empty monasteries or empty retreat centers if they really all needed to meet, which it's probably not necessary for all of these guys to come together. You know, so there are many different ways that the USCCB could be structured. And, you know, if you go to the USCCB building in D.C. and you look at, like, the documents they produce, there are all these ridiculous glossy brochures on environmentalism and immigration, and all that stuff could be wiped away without any detriment to the faith, and it would save the faithful millions of dollars. You know, I found out, you know how much money Chico Noguchi, the spokeswoman for the USCCB, she's now the spokeswoman for the USCCB, but she was Wuerl's press secretary, or one of his press secretaries, and she was making $200,000 under Wuerl, which probably means when she went over to the USCCB, she probably said, hey, Wuerl was paying me $200,000, you should pay me $200,000. So it wouldn't surprise me if she's making $200,000. Wouldn't surprise me if most of their lay staffers over there are making more than $120,000. Mm-hmm. And all of those people could be fired today without any detriment to the faith. The USCCB is not part of the essential structure of the church. You know, when Jesus Christ set up the church, he didn't say, hey, disciples, you better, you know, when you go to the ends of the earth, when you go to the four corners of the earth, make sure to set up national conferences and hold meetings at the Marriott. And, you know, all of this stuff is completely superfluous. It's not part of the essential structure of the church. It doesn't contribute to the mission of the church. In fact, it undermines the mission of the church by making the church basically a temporal rather than a spiritual institution.
Yep. Yeah, this is a big problem. And the lay people, one of the good things that happened after the Summer of Shame is the lay people woke up and they said, wait, there's these annual meetings in D.C., Baltimore that are going on. I've been to one. I went to one in, I'm going to say it was 2006. And I was kind of scandalized. I was a brand new Catholic. And I saw the steak dinners and I saw everyone walking together. I saw people going in and out of rooms. I'm not alleging anything happened, but just to me, third party, you know, I had been an Episcopal priest before. I knew we had very strict rules. Like, you don't ever go behind closed doors with parishioners or lay people. And I saw all these things happening at the hotel. And, I was a little bit scandalized, you know, and now people are all waking up and they're like, wait, this is going on year after year. They get nothing done. They talk about their pet issues. It's really just a way for them to lobby and get better dioceses. If you're in, you know, some swamp diocese somewhere in the USA and you want to get up higher, maybe become an archbishop or a cardinal, get a red hat. You go there and you hobnob and you press the flesh. And you get to know these key movers and shakers. It used to be Theodore McCarrick. That was the guy you had to befriend. And you became one of, you know, you became part of that nepotism and you would get promoted. And there's other shady things happening there. Now the new movers and shakers are Wuerl, Supich, Tobin, etc. Say something a little bit about Houston, Cardinal DiNardo, the outgoing president. Is he under a cloud right now? I mean, his office got raided. Is that part of the reason why he's out and Gomez is in? I mean, what's going on here?
Oh, yeah, he's DiNardo comes out of the Pittsburgh, you know, so he was under, at one point he was associated with Donald Wuerl.
Yes, he was.
Before that he was a kind of part of the Cardinal Wright machine in Pittsburgh. Cardinal Wright was a very by all accounts, very active homosexual, and he's been accused also. He was accused of pederasty too. But Wright was responsible for the gay mafia in Pittsburgh, and so DiNardo comes out of that church ecclesiastical ethos, and I've always seen him as a double dealer. You know, he's not as overtly liberal as some of the other people who came out of that atmosphere. But he definitely plays ball with all those people, and he's been I went up to him last year at the at the in Baltimore, and I just tried to ask him some very basic questions about why the USCCB wasn't addressing the McCarrick scandal more forthrightly, and he could not have been nastier. Like he basically accused me of not loving the church, and you know, and that kind of thing. So I've had very negative experiences with DiNardo, but in terms of his leadership at the USCCB, there's not much to it. I mean, he was very deferential to the Supiches and to the Worrells, and he really didn't. I can't think of any major accomplishment he achieved as the head of the USCCB. Yep. So, and Gomez, as you're saying, Gomez it's going to be more of the same with Gomez, because Gomez, you know, he's going to be just a yes man for the Pope Francis lobby within the USCCB.
Yeah.
But it is interesting, though. It is interesting that Supich, Tobin, and McElroy did not put their names into the hat for leadership positions, because it's very possible they would have lost, you know, and they didn't want that embarrassment, and that embarrassment would have undermined their effectiveness as spokesmen for Pope Francis. So there is a slight divide, I would say. It's not a major divide, but it is a slight divide between the Pope Francis lobby and then the rest of the bishops who are privately perhaps ambivalent about the Francis papacy. There is some kind of divide there, and that explains why Supich and Tobin and McElroy wouldn't put their names into the hat for leadership positions.
Yeah, that's interesting. If we go back to the vote on the preeminence of pro-life, there was 69 bishops who voted the wrong way, as Bishop Strickland let us know. How many bishops are voting in this? What's the number? The total number?
I think it was like, I don't know, I'm guessing around 240-ish, okay. 250, something like that.
So what that means is you've got 69 who are straight up, we support Supich, Worrell, McElroy.
Yeah.
They're all in. And we know that their votes were likely in that number. So tell us about the shading on the other side. You've got guys who are willing to put their neck out and speak up, like Bishop Strickland, my neighbor here in Tyler, Texas. Chaput spoke a little bit, but what about the others? Are they watching? Are they upset about the Pacha idols? Do they agree with all of this? Where do they fit in? Are they just kind of go along guys?
Yeah, I think that there's sort of a group of like rubber stamps. But I think you have a contingent of bishops who are ambivalent about Francis. And I don't know how large that group is or how, you know, radicalized they are. I don't think they're very radicalized. I think Strickland, like if you were to say, you know, how big is the Strickland group? Well, my guess is it's probably, you know, five bishops or so. How big is the Chaput group? Well, that would be a lot bigger. I don't know how many that is. And then how big is the group of just rubber stamps, the people who are just watching and looking at the direction in which the wind is blowing? I assume that's a larger group. So, but I think altogether that explains why it was only 69 who voted for the Supich McElroy side. Yeah, you probably have, you know, 69 uber modernists in the conference, but then you've got, you know, you've got very gradations of modernism in the rest of the groups. But what I was struck by is that there's not a single bishop who will stand up and forthrightly question the direction of the church under Pope Francis.
Yeah,
that's news. It's news to me that there's not a single sort of outlier saying Pope Francis is wrong. You know, nobody, as one of my sources put it to me, he said they're all company men. They're all terrified of Francis, and they're all company men, and nobody's going to directly challenge him.
Right.
But I think, you know, given, you know, we know how much damage Pope Francis has done to the church, and given that, it's long past time for people to stand up and say that and to actively and explicitly resist a bad pope.
Yep.
You know, there's not a single bishop who'd stand up and say Pope Francis is a bad pope, and yet we know that he is. We know he is a bad pope. So
I need to make a correction because I made a mistake, George. Someone brought up in the comments. I said Supich said he was giving $500,000 to the USCCB. He actually said he gives $250,000 to the USCCB and $250,000 to the Vatican.
Oh, okay.
So it's $500,000 that does not stay in his diocese. So $500,000 leaves. So $250,000 he has to give to the USCCB and $250,000 he gives to Rome.
Okay.
I honestly don't know if that makes it any better. You know, what's worse, the Vatican right now or the USCCB right now? It's still a shame that $500,000 leaves the tithing, the donations of the lay people, and funnels into USCCB and Vatican business.
Yeah, and another scandal associated with USCCB is the amount of money that it passes on to lobbyists in Washington, D.C. To lobby for issues that have absolutely nothing to do with the mission of the church. That's a scandal. So you have the USCCB, they retain six, lobbyists who probably pull down $200,000 a year to promote all sorts of causes that are un-Catholic, or basically just representative of personal opinions of the USCCB leadership. And that's a scandal. I mean, all those salaries could be wiped away, and then the Chaput wouldn't have to raise $250,000 for the USCCB every year.
It's offensive. Yeah. What's the story? Everyone's asking, who are these bishops? Who are the 69 bishops who voted this way? As I understand it, all votes are secret. Is that always been the case, George? I mean, why can't we know which bishops are voting which way?
I don't know. I think that's always been the case.
Okay.
But I do find it ludicrous that the rationale for holding it at a hotel is that, oh, we're going to be transparent and
mm-hmm.
we're going to be open to the media and we're going to let people see how we operate. But in reality, I've been told that all the real discussions happen during the executive sessions. The private executive sessions, that's where the real discussions take place. And the public discussions are just theater, are just, and they try to put on a happy face and present a unified front. In fact, I heard that McElroy was really upset that Chaput challenged him during the televised, in public session.
Yeah.
And I believe McElroy, said to Chaput, this is what I heard just through the grapevine, is that McElroy said to Chaput during the executive session, hey, we need to maintain a united front in public. And he didn't appreciate being called out by Chaput during the televised session. The other thing is they never give interviews to the media, so they're holding this meeting, the rationale is, oh, we need to be, we need to be accessible to the media. Well, when have they ever granted a real interview to a real journalist at any of these events? Maybe they'll give an interview to a J.D. Flynn because they know that he's basically just a propagandist for them.
Right.
But they're never going to give an interview to a real journalist.
Yeah.
And there's very little secular coverage of these events anymore because the secular world recognizes that nobody's listening to the bishops anymore. Their credibility is completely shot.
Yeah. Raymond Arroyo had a good tweet as this thing was rolling off. He said, they televised this to be transparent, but it's also bad because the bishops want to present a united front. And maybe if the television video cameras were off, they might actually speak more freely. It might actually be that there'd be some arguing and some debate on the floor because no one wants to see another bishop get shouted down on the floor. And there's a lot of guys who are afraid. They're not going to want to say anything because they don't want, a McElroy or, someone to turn off their mic and say, sit down. So I don't know. What do you think? Should this be televised or should they turn off the cameras and be big boys?
I think they should, just jump the whole Marriott
Just cancel the whole event.
Yeah, I'm in favor of discontinuing all these meetings, and I really don't see any real need for a U.S. conference. I would be very happy to see the USCCB just dissolve. And it's you know, all it does actually is undermine the good guys and embolden the bad guys.
Yeah. What would happen if you had a group of bishops? Let's just say there's five. Please, heaven, that there'd be five. Who say, you know what? I'm not giving $250,000 to the USCCB. That check is canceled. Ripped it up. Oh, and by the way, I'm not coming to Baltimore next year. In fact, we're going to go to this monastery and just fast and pray while you guys are out there. What if there was a little resistance movement that said, we are no longer, we're boycotting USCCB. What would happen? Could anything happen? Would the Pope cancel them? I mean, what would go on?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't think any canonical penalties would ensue from that. Maybe there'd be all sorts of behind the scenes retaliation, but that would be great if you had. I mean, if you had 10 really strong bishops who were willing to say, we're, you know, the church is in the hands of a bad pope, and we have to preserve the faith, even if that means actively resisting this bad pope, and we're not going to be going to USCCB meetings anymore. We're not going to give a dime to the USCCB, and we're not going to support any non-Catholic or anti-Catholic causes that are emanating from Rome. That would have a massive impact for good on the church, and it would be completely consistent with the tradition of the church, which is, you know, as Saint, we need to, you know, we're long past the point where the Bellarmine option needs to be implemented. You know, Robert Bellarmine said, you know, members of the church have not only a right but a duty to resist a bad pope, just as, you know, just as you have the right to defend your body against attack, so you have a right to defend your soul against attack, even if that attack is coming from a pope. And so the Bellarmine option needs to be talked about much, much more. And we need bishops to stand up and cardinals to stand up and talk about that and actively confront this bad pope. That's where we're at right now. I mean, we can't, this is not, to me, this isn't even a debatable issue. It's, you know, this is a time for action. We know the situation. We know the depth of the crisis in the church. Now the question is, what are we going to do about it? And it's the cardinals who have the power to confront the pope and to say to the pope, do you actually support the teachings of the church? If you don't, then you have self-vacated the chair of St. Peter, and we can move to elect a new pope. I know that with the current composition of the conclave, this is a dream scenario. You know, this is fantasy land.
Who would they elect? Yeah,
this is fantasy land. But that's what would happen in a healthy church. A healthy church would respond to the crisis in that way.
Yes, I think, you know, it's interesting you're bringing up the Bellarmine, because I've been studying it. Anyone who's following this and realizing we just had idols placed at the tomb of Saint Peter is reading this stuff, you know, is reading their Bellarmine.
Right.
And I think the reason why no one will say that with regard to American prelates, bishops, cardinals, is because once you light that fuse, it could go all the way to the top. You know, if you start saying, well, these are heretical bishops, these are heretical cardinals, prelates, then that starts raising the question of heretical pope. Schneider's already broached, you know, the question. Burke has as well. Bellarmine's, he puts out five opinions on how this all works out. I'd encourage people to read them. I organized them and put them up on Twitter. But there's five opinions on it. And Bellarmine's is, when someone is a manifest heretic, even a pope, they cease to be a member of the church and no longer hold their office. Now, manifest, of course, is the main word. What does that mean? It seems to me, the way I understand it, is that would require a ecclesiastical decree and it's not obvious how that would happen. That you would, and it seems to me that you, like you said, you would have cardinals have to make this decree, just like it would take cardinals. Let's say that, you know, the Pope had Alzheimer's and could no longer communicate. We couldn't all just say he has Alzheimer's, he's not the Pope. It would take some sort of ecclesiastical decree to say, okay, he has lost his mental faculties. He's, it's as if he had died. He's not dead, but it's as if. Therefore, the see is vacant. We now move to an election. So I just, you know, people ask me all about the sede question all the time. I just don't see how we as private lay people can make that determination. I became a Catholic because I believe in a church and in rules and decrees, and I don't want to make it up as I go, private interpretation. So there needs to be some mechanism to trigger that. But I think people are even afraid to talk about it at all because, again, once you light that fuse, the, you know, the crate full of dynamite may actually be not in the USCCB. It may actually be in the walls of the Vatican, and that could blow up.
Right. But yeah, it's the cardinals who speak for the church, you know, and they, if, you know, yes, you know, we as individual members of the church couldn't, you know, we can't make the declaration, the chair is empty, that, you know, that's, but the cardinals collectively could make that determination. And that's not a case of deposition. It's a case of declaration where they're simply declaring what Francis himself has done through his actions and his statements, that, you know, he would in effect have self vacated the chair of St. Peter. And then the cardinals would simply come in and declare that that's happened and then move to fill the chair with a new pope. But, you know, I think we are at that stage where that should happen. But I know it's fantasy land at this point to think that it will happen, right, given the given that there are so few determined anti-modernists within the conclave. It would take, you know, you'd have to have, you know, 20, 30 Burkes basically for that to happen. And I know from being in Rome that you probably have, I'm sure you've got 6, 7, 8 cardinals who think that Francis is an apostate, but only two of those guys, I guess, are willing to say that, or at least imply that publicly. Right. But, you know, we need to talk in terms of what should happen, even if realistically it's not going to happen. We nevertheless, it does not hurt to talk about what should happen. And we should stop pussyfooting around and saying, you know, oh, this is a misunderstood pope, or this is a pope who's merely, you know, he's merely fallen into material heresy. You know, does anybody really think if Robert Bellarmine were alive today and he read Amoris Laetitia and then he saw the comments that Francis has made to bishops around the world saying, yes, of course you should give communion to people who are divorced and remarried. Does anybody really think that Bellarmine wouldn't consider Francis to be a manifest heretic? That would certainly qualify as manifest heresy for Bellarmine, you know.
Or even just as simple as a pope saying previous popes were wrong on the death penalty. Now right. We know better. That, I mean, again, remember the pope speaks on faith and morals. He's only infallible when he speaks ex cathedra on faith and morals, but the pope's realm is faith and morals. Death penalty is morals. It pertains to the deposit of faith. It pertains even to sacred scripture. So that even that right there, I mean, not even getting into Abu Dhabi document, Amoris, any of these things, just that in itself is a violation.
Right. Yeah. No, it's, yeah. I think I know that, there are issues about, you know, pinpointing formal heresy, you know, to pinpoint formal heresy, you do have to know the heart and mind of the person. And that's obviously very difficult to do when the person is refusing to answer questions, as this pope has done. But at the same time, the cardinals, I guess this requires further study, but I do believe that the cardinals could, based on existing evidence, they could reach the conclusion that Bellarmine discussed, which is we have seen manifest heresy from this pope, and because of its habitual character, it's reasonable to conclude that that is its willful manifest heresy.
One last comment, and that is, you know, a major blemish that just muddies everything the USCCB is doing is the testimony of Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano. He exposed so many things about a little bit over a year ago, going into the 2018 USCCB conference. And I think there was only one bishop who mentioned Vigano and called for a condemnation against him. Was there any mention this year about Vigano? Because he's kind of the ghost that haunts the USCCB.
I didn't hear a single word uttered about Vigano. And I think that I think the bishops have been basically told the less he's mentioned, the better. Mm-hmm. Because it's so obvious that Vigano has been proven right. He's been vindicated time and time again. And this DiMorzio business is further confirmation of what he's been talking about. The Supich appointment, which Vigano talked about, I've been told by multiple sources that is 100% true, that was all orchestrated by Theodore McCarrick. Because Supich was not supposed to get Chicago. That was a last-minute appointment. The person who was supposed to get Chicago was actually Barron, you know, who's not, as we know, he's hardly a pillar of orthodoxy. But Barron, but it's funny that Supich and Barron hate each other, as you probably know. And that hatred is played out through Michael Sean Winters, who's Supich's buddy. Whenever Supich wants to attack Barron, he goes to Michael Sean Winters and says, write a column against Barron and portray Barron as this egghead. That's the latest attack by Michael Sean Winters on Barron, is that he's this egghead who doesn't really understand the evangelization under Francis or something like that, which is, at any rate.
I'm surprised to hear that. I mean, I knew there was some friction there, but I'm surprised to hear that because I've observed over the past year Barron cuddling up to the USCCB leadership. He was the one who made the announcement on the USCCB endorsement against the death penalty. They chose him. They also gave him the floor to talk about how to evangelize the unaffiliated. He had a real long speech with a lot of points in it. It seems to me that they're promoting him and he's cuddling up. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're not. No, it's just, I think the Supich Barron rivalry is due to the particular circumstances of Supich's elevation, and it doesn't have any. I don't think it has a larger. I think it's mainly a personal rivalry rather than a philosophical rivalry, and it speaks to how far left Supich is, that he thinks Barron is somehow too conservative. But at any rate, I was just talking about that because it Vigano. When Vigano said that McCarrick went to Rome and he told Francis, I want you to make Tobin a cardinal. I want you to make Supich a cardinal. And I think he promoted, who else did he promote? I think it was Tobin, basically Tobin and Supich. Those were, as Vigano said, McCarrick selections. And we're still living with the consequences. This is in many ways, Am Church is still Theodore McCarrick's church. You know, this is the church of Theodore McCarrick. It still is. And we're living with the consequences of that every day.
Yeah. My observation on this, and tell me if I'm wrong, George, this is just me watching the events over the past couple of years, is before everything in the Francis machine got revved up into fourth gear, you had in America, the Theodore McCarrick party, who were your liberals, who had been against John Paul II and had been against Benedict XVI, who had connections with St. Gallen Mafia. It's all in Infiltration if you want to read about that. And then you had the new emerging Ratzinger B16, and I'm going to put scare quotes on it, conservatives. And these guys were Dolan, Gomez, and Barron, and Chaput, right? Yeah. And as we've watched, you know, we're now in 2019. So as we watch 6 years of the grind of the Francis machine. What we saw is we saw who was the one who blew the whistle on McCarrick in the public and made a big old nasty splash for the U.S. bishops. Dolan.
Yeah.
Dolan was the one that blew the whistle. And I think Dolan thought that maybe he would be rewarded or maybe he would put down finally Wuerl and McCarrick and Supich. But I think it kind of backfired on him. And he didn't get any support from the United States or from Rome. And so what I see happening is I think Gomez, especially now, Dolan, Chaput less so, but also Barron, is they're finally resolving themselves to this is the way Rome is. This is the way that the USCCB is. I'm going to play ball.
Yeah.
Do you think I'm accurate on that?
No, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, that the Gomez, what your interpretation of Gomez's elevation is correct. And you know, yeah, this is the USCCB is a puppet of the Francis crowd. And the guys pulling the strings behind on the, you know, the strings attached to Gomez's back are being pulled by Supich and Tobin and Wuerl, and not so much by, you know, this was sort of the siren or the swan song of Chaput, you know, and I have to give Chaput credit for at least getting in a few last licks before his retirement.
Yeah.
You know, so that was kind of fun to watch, but under Gomez, it's just going to be, you know, totally pro Pope Francis business as usual stuff.
Yeah. Also, I was this morning before we rolled video, I was thinking, you know, their agenda, which is all about immigration and anti-racism and globalism, they sure look like a club of a bunch of old white guys.
Oh, yeah.
So they need to sprinkle some color in. I think that's what they're going to do. I think they're going to, okay, we got Gomez as the president. We got Latino. You know, they're going to need an African-American. You know, they need to work on their image, just like the Democratic Party has for the past 10 years. I think that they're also going to realize, hey, we can't look like a bunch of old white guys. We need to bring in some variety. You think it's going to happen?
Yeah. You look out at the bishops and it's worse than an AARP meeting. It's, you know, it's just all these old white guys. Yeah. And they're all from the same era of a bad formation under, you know, seminary formation. And they have they really have nothing to say about the things that really pertain to the mission of the church. You know, it just seems like a spiritually dead body.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for being there, George. And thanks for all your observations and your feedback on all these questions. I'll just remind everyone, I don't want people to think that I'm always just throwing the hat out for you, but I think it's necessary. Look, this is not CNA. This is not Catholic Reporter. This is George Neumeier. Shoestringing it, bootstrapping it. So I just encourage everybody to support George because he gives us the other side of these stories. And he's there. He's in Rome. He's traveling around. He's in D.C. He's following the Monsignor Rossi's. He's doing all that stuff. So I really appreciate him. I get a lot of good information. I like his perspective. It's helpful to me to stay, you know, current on all these things. So I'll ask everybody, please support George Neumeier. And the way they do that is, George?
They can support me through my GoFundMe account. It's called George Neumeier's Journalism Fund, and you can find it either on my Twitter or my Facebook pages, both of which are easily accessible. Or you can simply type George Neumeier's Journalism Fund into Google search, and it should come up. So thank you very much for having me.
Now, George, I've been telling you, you need to get something a little more sizzle.
Yeah.
The George Neumeier Journalism Fund, it's good. It tells us what you're doing, but there needs to be a little sizzle on that.
Yeah, I need to devote a little thought to that. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so everybody, Google it, search it. I'll put the link like I did last time in the show notes beneath this video, so you can simply just, it's not there as we're doing it live, but as soon as we get off, I'll add it. So you can just click the link I'm a supporter, so I'd encourage everyone else to be a supporter. And then just to remind everybody, please subscribe to this channel. That way you get the live streams. We're doing the live streams 2 to 3 times a week. And if you hit subscribe and hit the bell and hit all notifications, anytime we go live, you'll just get a little notification on your computer or phone. Taylor Marshall Show just went live. That way you can join us in the live stream. And please like this video. That tells YouTube that you like it and it'll share it with other people. Please support me on Patreon. You can do that and support this show. And I'll also send you signed books, merchandise, etc. at patreon.com/ Dr. Taylor Marshall. And please subscribe to the second channel, which is all the highlights, the best of this week, chopped down in consumable portions. And that's Dr. Marshall Highlights. Looks like you wanted to say something, George. You got something else?
Oh, no. I just thank you very much for having me on. And I appreciate the continued support from your audience, which has been very, very generous. Thank you.
Awesome. Okay, let's close in a prayer. We'll pray the Hail Mary in Latin and the Glory Be. And I think we should pray this. We'll pray this for the United States bishops. We'll ask that Our Lady obtain special graces for them, that she wraps her mantle of protection around them. If there's any demons, maybe, affecting the United States bishops or the conference, that she would drive all those away, and that we would see just good, holy bishops who are on the illuminative way, who are on the unitive way, striving for union with Christ and leading millions of souls with them. So that's what we're going to pray today when we pray our Hail Mary, our Ave Maria. And then we'll just pray a Gloria Patri, thanking God for the work of George Neumeyer. Nomine Patri, et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus, et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Jesus. Sancta Maria, Mater Dei, or pro nobis peccatoribus, nunc et hora mortis nostrae. Amen. Gloria Patri, et Filio, et Spiritui Sancto, sicut erat in principio, et nunc et semper, et in saecula saeculorum. Amen. Nomine Patris, et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. All right, George Neumeyer, thanks for being on. Everybody, look over this weekend. Alexander the Dunker Chiguo, you know, George, the guy who threw the Pachamama idols in the river?
Sure, yeah.
He's flying into Texas. He's going to come here and stay with me. I'm going to go pick him at the airport in a few hours. So he and I will probably do a live stream and talk about stuff like that related. So if y'all are interested, make sure you subscribe and you'll get notified when we do that, maybe this evening or tomorrow or something like that. So George Neumeyer, everybody support him. George Neumeyer, Journalism Fund, Google it, look for the link. Everybody, thanks for watching. Pray the rosary. I would recommend maybe give a decade to the U.S. bishop. Definitely be praying for your bishop wherever you live. You must pray for your bishop. He needs help. He needs protection. He needs grace. Thanks, everybody, watching. George Neumeyer, thank you very much. We'll see you in shows to come. Godspeed.
Thank you.